Welcome to Parents' Perspective. All right, crowed 7-year-old Anthony. I see it. I see the hole with the ants. That's right, Anthony, Mr. Carr, his teacher, bent down to where Anthony was squatting in the dirt. That's where the ants live. You can see them coming in and out of their home. Cool. Anthony's friend Graham wandered over and peered down at the parade of ants. Where are they all going? Let's follow them, suggested Mr. Carr, and see what they're up to. Hey, called Benji, here's a bunch with this dead beetle. Neat. Why don't we watch and see what they do? Mr. Carr joined a little group huddled around the beetle. Do you remember when we talked about what all living creatures need? From a parent's perspective, what should we know about schoolyard habitats for learning? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Today's guest is an expert on schoolyard habitats. Mary McLean is a career changer, starting out with Smithsonian History Museum and Library of Congress research, and then shifting to full-time volunteer parent with PTA, church, classroom, and outdoor learning. She then returned to school and became a teacher with the public schools of Arlington, Virginia. Both master gardener and master naturalist, Mary now combines her love of nature with teaching children lessons from across the curriculum in all grade levels as the outdoor learning coordinator for the Discovery Schoolyard at Tuckahoe Elementary. Mary is the parent of three, one in high school, one in college, and one out with a job. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Mary.
Thank you, Sandra. Thank you, Linda. I appreciate you having me here.
Mary, what is a schoolyard habitat, and why should a school have one?
A school should have a habitat because one of the first lessons we teach the kindergartners about habitat is what you need is the same thing that every other plant and animal needs. And so I parallel with them, what do you need during the day? You need water. You go to recess. You have water after you run around at recess. Right before recess, you go to lunch. Every animal needs water. Every animal needs food. What else do you need? You need a place to keep you in out of the rain and snow. You need shelter. Every animal needs shelter. And usually because of the National Wildlife definition of a schoolyard habitat and their program on schoolyard habitat, we also add what kids get a big kick out of, which is the special place for every animal to raise its young. And they all know about nests, and it's easy for them to understand, especially if they have younger siblings, that there's a special place for human infants to be and a special place for animal infants to be so that they can be raised. So just like every child needs a habitat, every animal needs a habitat, and when they're ready for it to understand that every plant needs a habitat as well, and how they're all interrelated and work together, and how we share the resources of our habitat. So that's why every school should have one, because every child needs one.
How does such an environment work, a schoolyard habitat, for a variety of different schools and programs?
A schoolyard habitat can really fit any school's resource availability, because if you literally just step outside your door, there will be some sort of animal who lives in that habitat. Even if it's an urban school that has no grass whatsoever, there are street birds that would live there. So you can do a habitat study literally wherever people live, because people are very commensal. They're very willing to share their resources. So there often will be puddles on sidewalks. There'll be food that people leave around. So even what you think is the most uninhabitable habitat actually is one that we share with other animals. So you can do a habitat study with very limited resources, or you can be fortunate enough, as we are, to be adjacent to a wooded park and to look at a habitat that has only minimal human intervention, that having been a farm and then some invasive species. So you can study how people impact habitats, even in ones that look pretty pristine for an urban setting. So it fits everybody's resources, really.
Can you give us an example of how a schoolyard habitat operates?
Well, if you're looking at a habitat under the definition of the National Wildlife Federation, you immediately run into one problem, which is a water resource. But if you look at what animals actually use and need, you can fit it into what we use now as our habitat. The habitat is under the third grade, and it's also a shared resource by the whole community. So we literally have two areas that we specifically designate as habitats, and a third one that we've developed that's right next to the school itself. The first two under the fifth grade, adjacent to the fifth grade buildings and shared by the whole school, is one that we developed under the criterion of the National Wildlife Federation. And at one point, we had a temporary bird water feeder, you know, bird bath in the habitat. But currently we don't. And so under their definition, technically it would count as a National Wildlife Federation habitat. But if you look at the needs of animals, for instance, a squirrel doesn't, like many rodents, doesn't actually need open water because they get a lot of their water from the food they eat and also from the sap of trees. So it can actually be a suitable habitat for a lot of different animals if you look at it as their temporary location, or if, like birds, because they can go somewhere else for the water, they can get almost everything they need, and then they can fly for us over the top of the building into our courtyard where we do have open water that's available for birds. So if you broaden that definition away from the National Wildlife Federation's strict definition of having to have open water available, then you can count a lot of areas fitting all those needs of a habitat. Each one of our grade levels at Tuckahoe, starting with the preschool and going up through the fifth grade, has a designated outdoor classroom, which is a portion of the outside of the building, the perimeter around the outside of the building within our schoolyard, that is their area to study, maintain, and use in whatever way fits with their curriculum, as well as the resources of what's there.
In some of the literature about schoolyard habitats and outdoor learning and everything, we've heard the term expedition days. Are they important, and if so, why?
At Tuckahoe, they're traditionally very important, partially as an anecdote to standards of learning that some people say children spend too much time on, but also as a wonderful way to create a spirit of group cohesion in the school itself. Our expeditions have been part of our program for 12 years now, and they're always cross-graded groups that are given a topic to study. Currently, they go out for 2 hours, 1 hour one day and 1 hour another day, to study whatever the topic they've chosen. And it can be second, third, and fourth graders in the group. And it's usually a small group. So it is like an in-house enrichment. But because it's small group learning, it's very effective learning. We always have 2 adults with each small group. And that group can vary anywhere from 7 to 12 children. So it's a heightened experience. Sometimes what their topic is something that they're all learning about, that the adult may be no more of an expert than the students, but rather be their guide if they're discovering what's the difference between a weed and a non-weed, a weed and just a regular plant. Then again, you may also have someone who comes as an expert to the topic, and the other adult may work as a specialist. For instance, we have one expedition coming up that's going to be about trees, and so the parent who's leading it knows a lot about and has learned a lot about trees in this particular area. She's not originally from here, but she's acquiring knowledge about the East and the Eastern Forest. But she's working with a teacher who obviously has a language arts specialty, and they're going to be making books to send to students in Uganda as part of their expedition. So the parent is the resource about the trees, and the teacher is the resource about what are the standards for putting together the book. And then the program to send the books to Uganda gives them the schema as to how they should do them, that they should be in English, they're for English study, and they should be a content about the United States. So the students in Uganda who are learning English will have a book about an English-speaking country, as well as some vocabulary that would be useful when they come to this country or if they're using English in a profession, an international job.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion of schoolyard habitats.
The popular new book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents, by Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We are talking with Mary McLean about schoolyard habitats for learning. So expedition doesn't mean you get in a bus and go somewhere.
No, we use expeditions as expeditions into the outdoors. Sometimes in the past, they were expeditions into a specialty, so they may not have necessarily been completely outdoors. There may have been an outdoor component and an indoor component. Before our boiler was redone, our old head custodian would take the children on a tour of the boiler. And part of the boiler's outside and part of the boiler's inside. So he's using his expertise, but it's not all outside, but obviously the boiler is something that's very important to the physical plant of the whole school. But traditionally, they may go outside and collect something and then come inside and make something from what they've collected outside, whether it's an artistic placemat or whether it's these books or whether it's photographs that they may have taken with digital film or with some print photosensitive paper. So they may be producing something, or they may just be having an experience, like when the students go out and do orienteering. They're just going out and running it, learning how to run an orienteering course.
So it's more of an in-depth study of something.
Yes, exactly. It is an in-depth study in that you're focused on one topic for an hour. But trees, it's hard to get in-depth for years on something like trees.
Schoolyard habitat seems so appropriate, particularly for special student populations, for example, hyperactive kids. How is that applicable?
It's very applicable. Actually, there have been studies at the doctorate level on ADD and ADHD children when they're taken outside. When students who have attention deficit are taken outside into a natural setting, it's more easy for them to have attention when they return. It's like it is a safe haven for them. I sort of go back to that concept that habitats are natural. The outdoors is natural for people to be in. And if you think about a student who needs a restful place, it is a very natural place. The green of it may give them extra rest. There is something peaceful about being outside in a relatively natural setting. Like I said, even if it's paved, you still, for the most part, can look up even in between the buildings to see something that is restful and infinite. And when your eyes go to infinite focus, they automatically relax. So there's some physical parts about being outside that do naturally relax a person. Part of it is that infinite focus. Part of it is the color green, if you're fortunate enough to have green plants in your outdoor schoolyard. And part of it is also because it relates to what's good for the human body, which is fresh air and moving around.
It seems like it would be harder if you had an urban setting to have that kind of feeling of outdoor and green space.
It is. Fortunately, a lot of urban settings have the gift of having a park system. So it's not unusual for a school not to be very far from a park in an urban setting. And similarly with schools that I'm familiar with in true urban areas are often not that far from actually a really nice park, or at least an area that is more open. Thinking creatively is the main thing, and really assessing your resources. One of our mentors, Martin Ogle, basically said, all you need is a tree to really have a habitat. And that's the truth. And even in very urbanized areas, there's usually a few street trees.
So a schoolyard habitat can be extended to be a community or a nearby neighborhood habitat.
It's very important because the best environmental education, if you go to the National Standards for Environmental Education, the most effective environmental education has three components. One, obviously, is that it be tied to the science curriculum, that it have standards, that the children be doing authentic science. And a lot of times the science that students do within the classroom is not necessarily authentic science. But when you go outside, if you are taking information on the birds that have arrived, you can report them to Cornell, and they'll put them in a national study. If you go outside and notice when specific plants are blooming, you can put them on the website Budburst, and that's part of an international scientific study about phenology or how things change through the seasons, which is both of them are baseline information that helps show that global warming is real. And that's what students can do. The third part, of course, is that the students feel like their learning is effective, that they can make a difference in their world. It not only is important for any kind of learning that students have that experience, but particularly for environmental learning, for them to feel like they have a connection to their environment. If they can know that they affected it, if they can know that they improved it, then that learning will stay with them for their whole lives. When I asked my principal what was the one surprise about her program, to her, the surprise was it stayed with them into middle school. I wasn't surprised at all, but it's wonderful that we have demonstrable evidence that once you give kids this experience, it does stay with them, and that is the best kind of learning. And if you want good environmental stewards, you want them to have that identification with the community. So yes, take them out into the broader community, whether it's collecting trash, whether it's handing out pamphlets to show people how they can clean up their watershed by picking up after their pets. Those are all ways that students can impact their community and benefit that community by improving the quality of the water for everybody who lives there.
Now, we've started talking about connection with community. We've heard that having a schoolyard habitat builds a stronger sense of community. Can you think of examples where you've seen this really happen, where the kids have connected more with the community, maybe the parents too?
Certainly. Part of it is because of how our program is designed over time, and then over space, and then over the community itself. Over time, our program has an infinite renewability because we're doing gardens. One class may plant the garden, the next class may harvest it. So that's automatically creating a time community. They were first graders in Peter Rabbit's garden before you. The kindergartners will be first graders in Peter Rabbit's garden after you. You're harvesting the potatoes that this year's second graders planted for you. You're going to be planting carrots so that next year's, the ones in kindergarten now, will harvest them where you've put them in. So there is that sense of caring for things because they're ours, because they're our responsibility, but also because they belong to that greater community. When I take the kindergartners around and show them the outdoor classrooms, all 11 of them that we have now, I'll sometimes ask them, who do you think this belongs to? And I just have to laugh to myself when they say, it's yours, Miss McLean. It's like, no, it's not mine. Yes, you see me out here, and yes, I wear the garden hat, but it's not mine. It belongs to, and then I always parallel that it belongs to all of the students and every plant and animal that lives there, so that they understand that it's always a shared resource, that it's something that, yes, they have the primary responsibility for if it's their bean sprout corner, if they're in kindergarten. But it's also something that they have a responsibility to take care of because of the animals that come there. And that sense of empathy is pretty easy to awaken in most kids who love to have a classroom pet and like the idea that these are their birds coming to the feeder. In the next level, which is sort of the wider community, those expeditions that I mentioned before, because they are second, third, and fourth graders working together in that small group, when I lead those group, I always insist that not only I have to learn everyone's name, but they have to learn one another's names, so that when they see one another later, because their recesses are prescribed by grade level, but I want them to know one another so that when they're on the bus together, they have another shared experience of having been on that expedition together. And ideally, they'll be in that expedition based on their own gifts and talents. Maybe the older ones will be the scribes for the expedition, but maybe the younger ones have a special knowledge of the topic. Say we're doing bugs, and the kid just knows all about butterflies. Then they can share something special so that people can understand that age isn't everything, because for elementary students, that age status is very important. But at the same time, it's important for them to understand that they're a shared community, that they're helping one another. One of the great things that's happened in our community recently is that the fourth grade has decided to adopt areas of the schoolyard that aren't formally belonging to any grade level. There are common areas, and that they're going to take care of the trash that's blown into that area or that comes in on the weekend. So sometimes the trash just gets left there. Sometimes it gets blown there. And so because they're cleaning up the entire schoolyard, they're showing sort of their responsibility to their school community as a whole, but also because it's a shared space with the larger community. All of our schoolyard is shared with the community. So that way we create a sense of community because people feel comfortable coming there on the weekend. People who have children in the neighborhood come and play in our schoolyard as well as on our playground. The last way that we bring in the larger community is as resources. The parents are important volunteers in our program. I couldn't do Peter Rabbit's garden nearly as successfully without the additional help of parents. Parents who may, on the weekend, make sure that the garden's ready. Parents who may come during the planting lesson to be sure that we're planting within a 20-minute space of time, which is what we have to plant, so that every child gets the experience of planting rather than just a representative one or two or everybody in a terribly big hurry, so that they can have a more quality experience. We increase the number of adults who are helping the students outside. So that community immediately becomes involved. We couldn't have this playground without the support of our PTA because we're part of their financial support. They put enough emphasis in their budget that we are a regular line item in their budget, not only for our ongoing maintenance of the schoolyard, but also in case we have any capital expenses. The last way is to bring in that larger community of resources. And we're very closely connected with the nature centers because we're adjacent to the county park. We also work with parks maintenance. A couple of our classroom areas are actually located within the county parks. So we literally share share resources with the Parks Department. So it's a great example of the kids working on a habitat and adults from the community, adults from the semi-commercial community helping us. And that's almost every project we do has that whole combination of a little bit from the PTA, a little bit from professionals, a little bit from our county.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on schoolyard habitats.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $15 with your name, mailing address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C. 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Mary McLean about schoolyard habitats for learning.
Have you had parents come in over the years and say, gee, as a result of this program, my child wants to plant a garden at home?
Yes, yes. Almost every year with Peter Rabbit, I do hear that story. We seem to have kind of a self-selecting community because we have been around for 10 years plus now, that a number of the people, when I do my survey at the beginning of Peter Rabbit and we'll ask, okay, how many people have a garden? It usually is about a third of the children have already planted a garden when they start out. And I don't know how when we started the program, whether it's that same number, but I guess it probably is pretty close. What I find is it's fun to mix age groups together and their different needs. And what's wonderful about bringing parents in is what has happened over time is many parents are like me. What started out as something they just enjoy doing with their children has become their job.
We had a habitat adventure in our family when my son, who was a young man at the time, lived in his first apartment with a little bit of land around it, very little bit of yard. And he planted strawberry plants because he likes strawberries. And I got a note from him saying he's having problems. Something's stealing his strawberries, and so he's going to have to watch his plants. And he discovered it was rabbits and squirrels. So he did a little research on the natural enemies of rabbits and squirrels, and he came up with this information that he would either need to get a natural predator, like a fox, to live in his yard, or he would have to buy dried fox urine and sprinkle it in his garden to save his strawberries. By that point, for that season, it was too late to save the strawberries. But it was interesting knowledge for all of us.
Yeah, that's what I love about working in the schoolyard gardens. Even a loss is a win. Several years, we had a very difficult time planting peanuts for the same reason that everybody loves to eat peanuts. And a couple of years, we were quite successful in planting our peanuts and putting urea on them to keep things from eating them. And we had a lovely crop of peanuts, and it's a great lesson. This past year, we could not win for losing. I think what happened is the gardens that we chose to put the peanuts in had literally been undermined by voles. In other words, their tunnels were underneath. So it didn't matter what I put on top of the peanuts. They were coming from underneath to relieve us of the peanuts. So we tried peanuts several times during the year. My parent who helped me with that one said, this year, we're doing them in the greenhouse.
Oh,
she must have
cute.
A locked door between the acquisitive little critters who want to eat what we're planting. Usually, we have sufficient planted so that we can actually be commensal. I don't know if you know the little children's book where the kid decides to share his garden with the rabbit, and he walls off part of it for the rabbit and part of it for him. But it's a great image because when you have a garden named Peter Rabbit, and they're reading the stories about Peter and his cousin Benjamin relieving Farmer McGregor of different things in his garden. And we try to somewhat rehabilitate Farmer McGregor by having them write a letter to Farmer McGregor about how they can help him improve his garden. The upshot still is they're very sympathetic with Peter. We do have little rabbits who live in the garden, and it's not unusual during a season, especially kids who go out early in the morning, for them to see Peter in the garden or for them to surprise Peter if we've left some brush in the center of the garden where the herbs grow.
What resources, Mary, would you recommend to parents and others interested in learning more about schoolyard habitats?
You want to look and find out what your Department of Environmental Services, what your EPA at the state level and at the local level is doing. They often will have resources, grants, individuals who can come to your school to help you set up curriculum guidelines for how to run environmental education outside and how to connect it back to the other parts of your curriculum. Then there's those agents that sort of cross the boundaries between them, and that would be your local extension agent. It's part of a federal and a state program through the land-grant universities. You want to identify who your land-grant university is that services your community and who that extension agent is. The other thing to look for is the local parks department to see if you do have nature centers or other resources. You may be one of the fortunate communities that has an outdoor lab connected with your school system, and you want to look for that to see if your community has a wild space, whether it's Central Park or whether it's an area that's maintained as a wild space. Local botanic gardens and nature centers are also places to do enrichment field trips, to go out to learn things that you might bring back to your school. Don't forget the basic ones, the National Science Teachers Association, the one for social studies and other sort of teacher curriculum resources. If you look up Arlington Public Schools, Virginia, and the elementary school, Tuckahoe, you'll find us. It is T-U-C-K-A-H-O-E, Tuckahoe. Budburst, if you pull up Budburst under your Google, you'll probably find it that way. But one that I would recommend that people do, even though it is a local site, if they haven't found their state environmental organization, it's just under the letters MAEOE.org. MAEO is the Maryland Association of Environmental and Outdoor Educators.
Well, we have had a lot of information today. We are so grateful that Mary McLean could be with us today to explain about schoolyard habitats for learning. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of The Foder's Guide, Washington, D.C. with Kids, 4th edition. Just call us toll-free, 1-800-791-8573, with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573, with your name and mailing address, and mention show number 398. And please spell anything that's not obvious. That's a big help to us. And tell us, if you can, what station you're listening to.
Visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org, where you can even listen to a show of your choice. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Today's program was made possible with generous support from our listeners. Our sound engineer is Nate DeLuca. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.